But what I want to talk about today primarily are a number of very broad habits of thought. Broad habits of thought that are largely unexamined. In fact, most of what we do in our physical and in our mental lives is unexamined because it is the product of habit, the habitual ways with which in which we deal with reality. And a number of habits of mind of the European Middle Ages, especially as they apply to reading, writing, and interpreting, not merely are different from the conventions that we are likely to bring to such activities, but in some cases are so very different that they're likely to cause some difficulties. Now let me start with a very broad one. It seems to me that by and large, as you look at medieval thought, as far as this goes, medieval thought, medieval European thought here, is the honest heir to classical Roman and Greek thought on this issue. The world is seen as being composed of a group of tidy, well-ordered, regular hierarchies. I mean, think of this in the first place at the political level. This is an imperial or a monarchical view of things. Most people in the Europe of the Ancien Régime, and of course this is what made the French Revolution revolutionary, is because it had a different point of view on this. Most people believe that the inevitable, indeed the God-given order of things was monarchical. There was a king. There was an aristocratic class. There are clear lines in society. Medieval society is organized in a feudal fashion. What feudalism was a series of binding contracts of hierarchical nature between overlords and subservients. And this went all the way from the king down to the lowest peasant in the realm. When one turned to intellectual life, it was thought that there also was a hierarchy there. For example, in the medieval university, it was often said that theology is the queen of the sciences, and that theology has as its disposal the other liberal arts which nourish it. The liberal arts themselves, the seven liberal arts, were, as you probably know, divided into two groups. The so-called trivium, that is the group of three studies, logic, rhetoric, and grammar, what we would call, I suppose, composition and literary criticism. These were the trivium, the three things joined together. It's from that word trivium, incidentally, that our adjective trivial derives. Trivial, not in the sense of being unimportant, but being introductory, the kind of thing that you learned at the beginning. You went on from that to the real hard stuff in the quadrivium, the four sciences that were joined together. And this habit of seeing practically everything in terms of tidied, structured hierarchies was a very, very common one, and it survived some of the great intellectual changes of the Renaissance and of the Reformation. And indeed, the world of the 18th century, the pre-revolutionary world of the 18th century, definitely was built around this hierarchical idea. This is the best of all possible worlds. A statement from Candide that is at once a positive statement and an ironic and pessimistic statement. This is the limit of things, a place for everything and everything in its place. Another phrase, whatever is right. Alexander Pope in that century trying to accommodate some of the great scientific advances of previous centuries with traditional ideas about literature, says, God let Newton be and all was light. That as we see now explained for us in the physical theories of Newton, what we knew already about this tidy series of hierarchies that make up the world. But when we get to the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century, we encounter a number of major seismic disturbances on this otherwise placid intellectual landscape. Let me try to describe some of them for you in a way that is pointing, as I say, particularly to the study of literature. Take a look at William Wordsworth, for example. Wordsworth is a poet that most of us know, at least most of us know something about him. He lived in that lovely so-called Lake District in the west of England, wrote all these marvelous poems, including a number of famous nature poems, one of which you will probably remember. He looks out at the meadow above one of these lakes, and he sees in a beautiful British spring a whole field of daffodils. 10,000 saw I at a glance. What a wonderful vision. And it is, for Wordsworth at this time, a religious as well as a poetic experience. Now, why is this? Well, he is a product of traditional European culture, which was, of course, a Christian culture, but he lives in a revolutionary age. It's impossible for him to believe in the most traditional and dogmatic way in the traditional teachings of Christianity. He is there a bit of a rebel. But he wants to have, as I think all of the English Romantic poets wanted to have, they wanted to have that transcendental element, as it were, the theological element that they found in earlier poetry. The idea that there was a realm of truth and beauty, of the immaterial and the unchanging, that lay beyond the veil of the senses. And for Wordsworth, the sight of those 10,000 daffodils is such a religious experience. And I think a lot of people, whether they think of themselves as religious or not particularly religious in the 20th century, are likely to have similar sorts of experiences when they see a spectacular sunset in the western desert, or they see the waves beating against the cliffs at the Pacific, or when they hear a symphony by Mozart or whatever it is. You can fill it in. That, seems to me, was the romantic perception of truth. Now, look what happens to that in the middle of the 19th century. What happens to that to separate us from it? In the first place, mild, inoffensive Charles Darwin comes along. And he says, indirectly, because he was the mildest of men, he says to Wordsworth and to all us readers of Wordsworth, "I've got very bad news for you as you look out and see those daffodils. Because I'm here to tell you that every one of those suckers is trying to kill every other one of those suckers off. And every bird is fighting against every other bird, and every butterfly is trying to kill off every other butterfly so that it can thrive and survive, the natural selection of the species. And in fact, the only way anything ever has happened in the realm of nature is through this somewhat gruesome and dynamic process. If what characterized the old world, as I'm calling it, are stable, tidy hierarchies, what characterizes the new world are dynamically interacting polarities. A two-bit phrase that's worth thinking about. You take your old thesis over here and your antithesis over here, and they smash together in the middle, and out of it, out of this conflict, comes some sort of resolution that we call a synthesis. And this tends to be, as it were, the way we think. And here you had Darwin saying that it was right at the very root of the physical world. Well, then people had sort of barely survived this, and you know what an impact Darwinian theory, in particular with regard to the selection of the human species, made in the 19th century. For people who thought they could believe in the very tidy hierarchy that is described in the book of Genesis, that you have a God who has created a very special race of people, mankind, that those people have a hierarchical lordship over the world of the animals, and this goes right down to the very clods of the earth, this caused, as I say, a lot of disturbance in that world. And hardly had the dust settled until, of course, Karl Marx came along. And Karl Marx said, "You ain't heard nothing yet. Because you thought I was out there with the daffodils and the butterflies, but I'm here to tell you," famous Marxist line, "all previous history is the history of class struggle."